media collective based in the Bay Area, in San Francisco and East Bay. And the members sitting here tonight, I'm Ian, and this is Sam, and in the back is David at the table. Before we get started, we definitely want to thank AK Press for having us here tonight. It's really great to have a space open for events like this, and we really appreciate it. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to ask the panelists to introduce themselves. So if you could say your name and what group you're with. And we're going to also ask you to kind of describe both what your group has been up to in the past few months, the geography and area which your group is operating in, kind of describe that and the situation there, as well as kind of describe the goals of your organization, how you see yourself operating in that sense. So we're going to start on the left here. And the event is being organized, or the event is being recorded tonight. So if people could be conscious of speaking in the mic, as we pass that.
Alright, so my name is Brian Helmley, and I'm from San Jose, here with some other folks from San Jose. And I do work with San Jose CloudWatch and Silicon Valley Debug. And the work that we do, I think, I'll just talk briefly about CloudWatch. People are probably familiar with the tactic. You go observe the police, you de-escalate, just your presence there de-escalates the situation typically, and they tend to be a lot more polite, at least to the people being arrested. And I think I'll just leave it at that and pass it on down here with some of the other San Jose folks.
Hi, my name is Gail Noble, and I'm from San Jose also, and I volunteer with Silicon Valley Debug. And I do the, we have Sunday meetings for social justice, and we work with clients that have cases, and we work with them, and we have an allegiance with the VA, the Public Defender's Office, and we just make sure they get the best legal advice that they can get while they're going through this situation.
Hi, I'm Maria Rosso, and I'm also with San Jose CloudWatch. I'm also participating in the meetings on Sundays at Silicon Valley Debug. And that's all.
Buenas tardes, good evening. My name is Tomas Alejo, and I'm from Watsonville. I'm a member of the Watsonville Brown Berets. We're here to talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing. And some of those points that I want to bring up in this beginning here is, you know, the type of presentations that we do for young people at the schools and the community level, and bringing information about gang enhancements, gang injections, and repression, and the war on youth, especially black and brown youth. So we really try to, you know, emphasize culture, education, and also that message of each one, teach one, right? And hopefully, you know, our work that we're doing can inspire other communities too.
My name's Jen Laskin. I also work with the Watsonville Brown Berets, and we've recently initiated a Know Your Rights training series for high school students. It's a long-term training series led by Katya Kamisarek, and it has a long-term goal that's going to take the students from learning their rights through really working systemically to change the behavior of the police in Watsonville. And we also serve as an informal resource for people at all, with all levels and all types of issues, either with their cases, with police brutality, with police repression, with WAC cases, any sort of trouble that they may be in. You know, they come to us, and then we can kind of serve as a networking place to help them out.
Hi, everybody. My name is Carl. I'm from Petaluma CloudWatch up in Sonoma County, as well as 022, which is a Sonoma County-wide organization that is does a lot of action and education around just issues of police brutality. And currently, we are organizing a campaign to get the sheriff to ban tasers. I'll probably talk a little more about that later, but a number of people have been killed by tasers up in Sonoma County recently, so that's what we're doing right now.
Hi, my name is Patricia. I'm with the COP and Migra Busters in San Francisco. We're kind of an offshoot from the COP Watch groups. We kind of started as being one as well, and we wanted to expand to include more of a focus as well with the criminalization of immigration, and we work against raids, we work against checkpoints for a driver's license, and we're also really strongly working against gentrification and how in areas of mission are seriously divided, and there are some very hot spots specifically for youth and youth of color, and so we do a lot of trainings, workshops with youth, and a lot of that involves theater and just role-playing and getting people engaged, and even if they're not in collectives, just be mindful of keeping an eye out when there is a COP situation or a MIGRA situation, and just participating and starting to get more involved in building up that community awareness. I think I'll answer more questions later. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Molly, and I live here in Oakland. I kind of was resisting putting myself out as a representative of one single group, but I think I'm going to go ahead and just say it. But I mostly organize with critical resistance in Oakland, and our objective with critical resistance is to build an international movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. So we try to end the reliance on the use of policing, surveillance, and incarceration. So we're not an anti-cop group, but rather an anti-use of policing in general as a response to conflict and harm. So specifically in the current climate in Oakland, maybe not all of you are living in the East Bay, but I'm sure you've heard about what happened with Oscar Grant and the BART police. And so the current climate with that, critical resistance's primary role was calling for the charges to be dropped of a lot of the young people who were arrested demonstrating in the streets in the aftermath of Oscar Grant's execution. And we also do a lot of work supporting and working to build critical relationships with family members of a lot of people, all people of color who have been murdered by Oakland police in the past 2 years. The count right now is over a dozen people have been murdered. And we also specifically have a campaign called Plan for a Safer Oakland. And rather than just trying to say what we don't want to see in Oakland, which is more cops, more cages, and curfews, we also want to call for what we do want. And I brought a document that we put together that's like our blueprint of what safety could look like in Oakland, and a lot of that has to do with increasing services and resources and ending the criminalization of young people, particularly young people of color, and then also specifically people who are re-entering their communities in Oakland upon being released from prison and detention centers.
Okay, so now we're going to move to questions, and the way that we decided to organize this section or this round is to go through the questions and have each panelist answer, and then at the end of the questions, we're going to open it up to you guys, so if you want to sit and think and write down any interesting questions or comments for the end of the panel, that would be awesome. So the first question is really basic, right? Really easy, you guys. It's what tactics, strategies, or campaigns have your groups deployed which have been effective at combating police presence and abuse? And Molly didn't want to go first, so we're going to go that way.
So, in terms of answering the question about what tactics, strategies, and campaigns we felt were effective in San Jose, I also just want to start by saying that in San Jose there's a history of fighting against police brutality
and injustice. Going back many years, we've had members, former members of the community alert patrols that were active from 1968 until 1972, who have come and talked to us, and we've been trying to build some relationships with them that was specifically, you know, going on in San Jose, incorporating some of the tactics like cop watching that the Black Panthers use, and overall just trying to kind of understand the context that we're operating in San Jose. Really, though, I'd say that the biggest thing that I've seen is the just absolute need for legal advocacy, that people are terrified of getting any kind of charge, and once they have it, they are typically abused by the public defender, who are either lazy or cowards or just don't care, or honestly, to be a little maybe more fair to public defenders, is that they are overburdened, that they have a large case. But the thing is that we're talking about people's lives, and I think that it's really important that there be some way to prevent people from getting sucked into the system, and then also, once they're in, help them extricate themselves, and do that by holding whoever is supposed to help them, like public defenders, hold them accountable. And that's the work that the Sunday group, the Debug, Silicon Valley Debug Sunday group, does every Sunday at 2:30. And I'll let other folks talk about their experiences with that. The overall work of the San Jose movement against police brutality and for like police accountability, about 90-95% of that work happens at Debug on Sundays at 2:00. So I'll just say that. And then I'll also say that one of the projects that we've taken on is cop watching, and I personally enjoy that. I think that it's worthwhile. I think that it's a tactic that people with some relative privilege in the system who either don't have priors, are white, are, you know, have some money, not for this amount, but at least some so that you can pay bail. There are places there where you can directly intervene in the relationship between the police and the people in your community. And that has had direct positive benefits to people in San Jose. There's been, any number of times where a carload of young, usually Chicano or Mexican folks get pulled over, usually men with real short hair, get pulled over, and if there's cop watchers there, oftentimes they'll just be released. But if there's not, or it's not as obvious, they'll be hung up there for 20 minutes, half hour, an hour, their car gets searched. So that's sort of like intake for the system, basically. They're just trying to snatch people up and grab them. And so, anyway, I'd say that there's some success that comes with cop watching as a tactic, and just want to pass it on in terms of other things people are up to in San Jose.
Okay, like our Sunday meetings, I'd say we advocate for justice. And so once these people are incarcerated or take a case, what Debug does is get in touch with the lawyer. And if we don't have any success with that, then we take it a step higher, supervisor, or the supervisor's supervisor. My son had caught a case, and Santa Clara Police Department Houston has an example. They put a 290 in his petition, and one of the tactics that I had finally used, in case you don't know what a 290 is, high-risk sex offender. My son was 16 at the time. He had committed no assault. But I had to go to different levels. I went to the board meetings for the city. I went to the board meetings for the county. Made everybody a copy of his petition, pointed out the paragraph I wanted them to pay notice to, which had the 290 in it, and I had the public defender's supervisor, Ann Rattle, come off the podium and say that she would help me, and they had to petition the court once again to get the 290 off his, out of his police petition, but they told me that it was IT error. Another case that we had was Ramon, which was charged with a homicide. And because of the interaction that we do like a buddy system. We go with you to your court date, we talk to your lawyer, we let the lawyer know that somebody has this person's back. And if it does, we challenge the lawyer. We get together and we do a brainstorm and we say, well, we go back to the lawyer and what about this, what about that? Well, Ramon was finally released after,
4 months
in jail. Charges was dropped, and he's now turned it into a citizen. So, but if it hadn't been for our savvy, we also work with a retired public defender that is our mentor on Sundays. And just being aggressive and not rolling over like we usually do. And so Ramon Sharps was dropped. Noreen Salinas' father was beaten, tasered to death a year ago on May 25th of this year. It would be 2 years. Finally, we finally got the police officers involved that was involved. We got their names, so it's going to trial. We also, the lawyer that she has is from LA, and he only took the case on contingency that she would sue the taser company. She's asked for $20 million, and this is a high-profile lawyer, and so it's going to, they had a hearing on May 19th, they have another one on May 26th, so by us being involved and not backing down, not going away, and just standing up for our rights, it's made a difference in San Jose, Santa Clara County. I mean, my name is like a byword. They hear Neil Noble and they're like, okay. So, and I just thank God for having an organization like D-Bug that walk you through this path when you get caught up in the criminal justice system. So, like Noreen's father, I know she's pretty proud of what Noreen is doing. So we do go the extra yard, and because of what happened to my son, like, we just did a habeas corpus on Tuesday, and the judge, not the judge, but the lawyer and the DA had to be on the witness stand for a comment that was made about my son. He's probably going over getting drugs when his attorney was trying to tell them of his summer job collecting Indian gang signatures. So, his case opened a lot of doors. It opened up the doors. And what we don't know is if you're not satisfied with your case, you can't appeal it. We have 60 days. Lawyers don't tell you that. We learned that for my son's case, the Sixth District Appellate Program said they got like 300 cases a year. So, you guys, go ahead and tell your friends. I mean, unfortunately, if something happens like that, they have the right to appeal. And if you're not satisfied with that, you go to the next level. You go to the next level. You go to the next level until I have exhausted all avenues after the habeas corpus. I appeal restitution. I appeal the charges. I appeal the, now we're at the habeas corpus. So I've been in the Superior Court, Supreme Court, and we're in federal court, and we're also doing the habeas corpus. My son was charged with assault and battery, and attempted to bring bodily harm, and he was getting a strike. So until I have exhausted all my avenues, I know that I put up a good fight for my son. And I know that we opened up doors because of this case with the power of Eva. I mean, it's like a family. Everybody does it. They have passion for it. So I can rest. If everything is denied, we got some money subtracted from the restitution part, but that was a small win, but still it was a win. So this is what D-Bug does every Sunday, 2:30, until we have walk-ins, until sometimes we have 20 people and we don't leave till the last person has been heard. And I've been with D-Bug since 2007, and I plan to continue with them. And
help other people. My daughters and I met D-Bug when we went to a march on No on Proposition 6. And my daughter has a friend who is incarcerated. I went to this preliminary hearing. He's being charged with murder. There are no facts, no evidence to support his being incarcerated, other than he has what they call gang affiliated tattoos. He's only going to be 20. And they were beating him. The correctional officers were beating him, trying to make him to confess. And these are the ones who gave us the advice on what to do, who to contact, what to say, to push it, to threaten to go to the media for them to do something, for the public defender finally to move him from where he was at when he was being beaten. D-Bug gives people a lot of peace of mind, a lot of help.
Mm-hmm. just want to say that personally, I'm inspired by all the work that the Greenbelt and the work that's been going on with gang enhancements and with the case of Joseph Heredia, you know, and tremendous work his mother and different mothers have done in the community to bring attention to that injustice. You know, I as a person have been dealing with this type of injustice for a large portion of my life. You know, I went through the criminal justice system as a young person, starting at the age of 14, through group homes, through juvenile halls, and then that went on to jails, and eventually the prison system, California State Prison System. But somewhere in that time span, I was able to educate myself, you know, through reading about my history and my culture, and really being inspired by the movements of the past, you know. And that's why, you know, I made the decision to be part of that movement, you know, and started working with the Watsonville Brown Berets. That organization was started by young people in our community who were also inspired. Historically, the Brown Berets organized or joined together to deal with the issues of police brutality, police repression in the barrios throughout Aslan. In the barrios of East Los Angeles, people were being harassed by the way they looked, the color of their skin, you know, how they spoke. And so they wanted to do something about it. And they knew the only way to do it is through unity, right? And building strength together and addressing these issues, you know, and not take it anymore, to stand in defiance and in resistance and in self-defense of their communities. And they begin to mobilize and organize that and inspire many young people to do the same. You know, they helped in the Los Angeles walkouts in 1969 and the Chicano moratorium and bringing attention to the drafts of poor people being used to kill other poor people in other lands. And so what was happening in that time frame is still happening today. When we started in 1994, you know, Watsonville was going through tremendous police repression and gang violence at the same time. That happens because of poverty and other conditions. And so we decided to one of the methods to address this was first to become aware of the issues, right? To research what's going on, to research the laws and inform each other, because we understood that we're not going to get this type of education through mainstream public media. We're not going to get it through the public educational systems, that we have to teach ourselves. And we get that. We pass that information along. And we did that through building coalitions also with other organizations. And also learning from the past mistakes and trying to correct those mistakes and having the courage enough to carry on the legacy of people who put some work in, to carry that legacy, but we have the courage enough to change those organizations and address those mistakes. Mistakes of sexism and machismo, of hierarchy, all those things had to be changed in order to bring a more just society. But we felt the Brown Berets were important. It was important because it has a respect in the barrio, and it has a respect in the prison system. And I really believe that it can be a tool to bring attention, right, to capture the attention of our young people, because it, just the way it captured mine, you know, I really... through experience have learned the effect that it has on other raza, black and brown peoples out there, and all people. So some of the work that we talked about earlier is bringing this information about gang enhancements and gang injunctions, just like what we learned from Hebrew, passing that information along in our community, inspiring mothers also to get involved, right, with us, because we have to build solidarity, right, with all sectors of the community. And also, know your rights training. And I'm going to pass the mic on. I think Jen wanted to talk about that.
And I just want to draw a quick picture for you of Watsonville. It's a rural community where half of the community is under the age of 25, with a relatively small police force. But what they've done is they've trumped up the gang problem so much, even the number of those young people that are actually affiliated or participating in violent activity that may or may not be related to the other young folks they hang out with. the police have trumped this up so much that they're receiving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in, you know, gang suppression money. And in a place like Oakland, yeah, you can see it, but in a place like Watsonville, it becomes utterly repressive to be a young man or woman walking in the streets. 85% of the folks in Watsonville are Mexican descent, and a smaller percentage are Latino. Everybody's brown practically, and so everybody fits the profile. So, you know, we're also subversive in what we do. I mean, just like the sister over here said, we want to create a community that is empowered to resist themselves. And we do that through providing a space for folks to come, a safe space, events where we, you know, subversively insert what we do and the education, the rights, going into schools. And because it's a small enough community, I mean, 60,000 people, we can build like that. So I think that that's an important thing to note as you listen to us tonight in our piece, is that we're not working in an urban setting. We do focus on the kids who are on probation and trying to get them into the mix as much as possible. We're a site for community service, so through students doing community service with us, that's another way that we work with them and just slowly but surely, you know, create again a community that's empowered to resist, you know, and it all starts in the mind.
Alright, so I was a little confused in the intro, and I forgot to talk about, like, everything you wanted us to talk about. So really quick, I'll just give some context on the context we're working in Petaluma, and then I'll just say a few things about what we've done that I think are effective. Similar to Watsonville, we're about the same size as Watsonville, maybe a little smaller. Okay. Petaluma is about...
Say where?
Huh?
What city?
Petaluma? Oh, yeah. About 50,000 people. It's a little more suburban, not quite as rural, it's much more white, middle class, but with a pretty large immigrant community as well. And there isn't a lot of, it's not a very politically active place. I'd say we're probably one of the only organizations in town that actually does any sort of political activity, aside from like elections, when elections come around. So that has its benefits and its downsides. But so I'd say the consciousness in general, in terms of police at least, is a little maybe not as elevated as maybe some more urban areas where people have to relate to the police a lot on a more frequent basis, and it's less of a kind of this small town setting. But so we formed in 2006 in response to a lot of harassment of political activists and basically the same as a lot of towns, political activists, homeless folks, immigrant folks, mainly youth of color, young males especially. And we formed in 2006 and started doing patrols and saw, after a long time, we were severely repressed by the police. We were regularly monitored. Since we're a small town, you know, they got to know where we all lived. They got to know all of our names. They'd call us out on the street. They would follow us to the store. They were following our relatives. They were showing up to our jobs and trying to get us fired from our jobs and all sorts of stuff like that. And it escalated to the point where they were arresting people on the street, not for cop watching, just like when they were alone on the street. They were starting to arrest people and charging them with robberies and stuff like that. And I'll mention here that most of the members at this point were from 16 to like 19 years old. The majority were in high school. And so they were arresting high school students on the street, you know, with no priors or anything like that, just for being cop watch, and they would interrogate them. That kind of went down, and then as we built the organization, it got to the point about a year or two ago where we were actually getting calls from people that would call us before they would call the police. Like, people knew us well enough to where they would call someone from our organization, say, you know, something's going down, like my son's having a mental breakdown, like I'm going to call the police, but I'm not going to call them until you guys are here, that sort of thing, because of how many people have been killed. And then Sonoma County, in general, there's two things unique about it, I feel like. For an area like Sonoma County, there's been an insane amount of police killings, police shootings, and deaths at the hands of law enforcement in prisons even. People have died in prison and jail there. I think in the last 2 or 3 years, I don't know the exact number, it's around 15 or 20 people just in Sonoma County have been killed by law enforcement. For a suburban area that's more or less affluent, it's a unique situation. And because of that, there's a pretty good wealth of organizations that exist now in response to this climate. Petaluma Cop Watch is one. There's a Santa Rosa Cop Watch,
just north of us, there's a group called PATCH, which is the Police Accountability Clinic and Helpline, which takes complaints about police abuse and documents them and gets an independent like record of all the police abuse going on and then works with people on their cases. And then there's O22, which I mentioned earlier, which does action on a number of different issues. We've had lots of big protests and stuff like that. And then, am I forgetting anything? Any other groups? Committee for Immigrants' Rights, which we work very close with, a lot of us are members of, which is running a campaign to stop the collaboration of our sheriff with immigration with ICE, because what they've been doing is just profiling people in the immigrant neighborhoods and stopping them, and the sheriff will ask them questions about their citizenship, and then once they find out or are suspect enough that the person that isn't a legal resident, they'll have an ICE agent with them and just hand them over to the ICE agent. And then that person will be deported, and we've seen a lot of that. So we're trying to stop that right now too. So there's a wealth of organizations doing, I think, police brutality and immigrants' rights, those two issues combined are really important there. Anyway, so that's just the background. And then as far as to answer the question that we're talking about, I took notes on this. I came prepared. Some of the things that we've seen that are effective, first of all, patrols. I don't need to go into it too much because San Jose folks talked about what cop watching is and what it does. And it can really be a deterrent. There's no way to know if it's a deterrent because we don't know. I mean, you don't know if that cop was intending on messing with someone or not. But like you said, a lot of times we'll show up and once they see us, they'll just drive away. A lot of people remark to us later that they feel that if we weren't there, that the cops would, that the situation would have been much worse. A lot of people just thank us, and we get overwhelming support from people, like 100% support from people that we observe for. So that's really good. I think that's effective. The cops know who we are. They know we're there. They know we're always present, and they're kind of expecting us to be there. So that's good. Secondly, education. Mega rights trainings like Watson, the Watsonville folks do. We've done dozens and dozens of mega rights trainings, mainly in schools and mainly for young people. And I think we've really cultivated a certain amount of consciousness, at least among the young people in town, to where now the cops know that if someone asserts their rights and says those words, like, I don't consent to a search, or I don't want to speak to you, the cops automatically say, oh, you're with Cop Watch, or oh, you know Carl. they're kind of on their guard now. And it's kind of had two different effects. I think for people with a relative amount of privilege, it can have a positive effect. It kind of tells the cops, like, hands off. But in a lot of mainly with the immigrant youth that we've like worked with, they've kind of told us that like, hey, like, yeah, I did what you said, and then they just arrested me. Like they said, you know, I said, oh, I don't consent to a search, and that gave them pretext to arrest them. So in some cases, it's almost had the reverse effect. So I don't know. I don't want to say it's 100% effective all the time. So I don't know. We're kind of working on that right now, I think. One other thing is media attention. As much as I think we all hate like the mainstream media, and it really 9 times out of 10 is going to screw us over, if you're able to manipulate it. Oh, time. I'm sorry. this is why I should have answered the first question the first time around. All right. Well, we'll talk more. Media, use it.
Okay, So I'm really enjoying what everyone's been mentioning and talking about. I'm hearing a lot of increasing subversion, increasing rebelliousness, and I think that's something that really should be promoted absolutely in the type of like defensive work that we do in the streets and also the offensive work that we do within our communities. And part of what we're trying to do mainly, since we're kind of a group that started up back in December, but you think we'd be like this big badass group already, but we're not. We're really not. There's a lot of people that come and go and continue with different projects. Unfortunately, we're competing a whole lot with the nonprofit industrial complex that like squishes people's time and commitment, especially those who are bilingual or who are already working in different issues with different communities. So that's a huge challenge that we're confronting as well. But basically what we're trying to do is build coalitions. So even for a small group right now, we build coalitions with other groups so that we maintain informed, we're passing on information, we develop those resources. So we have networks with the Immigrant Rights Defense Network in San Francisco, a really amazing immigrant youth Bay Area coalition called Stop the Raids Now, which if you're not familiar with them from their Halloween action, keep your heads up for July 4th. And also another group called Homey that works mainly with trying to keep kids and encourage kids who might be at risk of joining gangs or who have been part of that. there's a collective that's, if anyone here knows anyone who might be interested, there's a collective that's forming concerning people of color in theater. It's called POCAT, People of Color Action Theater. So if anyone's interested, please talk to me about that later. I'm trying to form a Bay Area wide group. And basically, we try to organize mainly with grassroots organizations, collectives. We are also very interested in maintaining a very radical orientation in terms of being completely against the prison industrial complex, against borders, against criminalization in general, and how that pits, you know, different groups of color against each other. So we do a lot of work that's trying to get youth, especially black youth, brown youth, Asian youth, to come together and to really work on our issues. You know, and theater has been like a really big help for that. So yeah, we try to focus on teach-ins, workshops, all day today. I've been at a high school doing workshops in different classrooms, so like, I'm not gonna talk a whole lot today, but I'll try. We have some material that we organize. We also have a 1-800 number, a hotline number, where we tell people on the streets, if you see anything going down, we have people here on the block that have cameras, we'll jump out of bed, go out there in the middle of the night, whatever. Like, just letting people know that this resource exists. And people love that. And if, you know, it's just like we feed off support and people get interested. And hopefully it encourages that whole dynamic of where they'll stop and they'll watch, you know, next time around. Yeah, so we try mainly again to focus with organizing with other collectives, with other coalitions, less with nonprofits, and especially not with government. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Thanks. So again, my name is Molly, and I work with Critical Assistance here in Oakland. And we do a lot of different kind of work to try to build a movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. And we've been around the Bay Area for 10 years now, so it's kind of hard to think. I've only been working with CR for the past 2 years, so it's hard to really capture all the different strategies and tactics that we use. For the most part, what I kind of mentioned before is that we try to look at instances in the most non-isolated ways possible. So for instance, with the execution of Oscar Grant earlier this year, focusing a lot on how that is not in any way an isolated incident, and that it's very much reflective and actually produced by the criminalization of particularly young men of color in Oakland. And so that's what we need to be responding to. And ways to respond to that, there's tons and tons of ways. Right now there are a group of people in the neighborhood around Market and 30th Street here in Oakland that are building a skate park, because how they saw the situation with Oscar Grant go down is that there's nothing for young people in Oakland to do whatsoever. And so that sets up particularly young people to just be kind of sitting on the street when they have nowhere else to go and nothing else to do to spend time with their friends, and then living in a militarized city like Oakland, it just sets up the opportunities for the cops to come and mess with them. So that's one example. More specifically, what CR is involved in is that we do a lot of relationship building. We do a lot of relationship building, like I mentioned, with family members of people who have been executed by the police, and then ongoing relationship building with people who are coming home from prison, and then also their family members while they're locked up. And one of the most successful relationships has been with the Maupin family. Andrew Maupin was murdered by the OPD last New Year's, the New Year's before Oscar Grant. And Andrew Maupin was a young man who was a member of an indigenous community here in Oakland. And we've been able to try to work with the Maupin family with the Intertribal Friendship House, which is the first urban Native American community center. So we do a lot of partnerships because we're a political education group and we do mostly political campaigns. We try to partner up with organizations and community centers that can provide the services that are needed to transform the material conditions in our lives that the prison industrial complex continues to destroy every day. And so IFH and CR partnership is one way that we do that. Another success is We work with Creative Interventions, which is another group that facilitates interventions in situations of interpersonal harm without involving police surveillance or incarceration. And the project that we're working on with Creative Interventions right now is the story collecting and organizing project. And so we're collecting stories all over the United States to archive and document instances of interventions in situations of harm that don't involve policing. And we're trying to develop, it's all audio recorded, and we're developing it in a way for it to actually be an organizing tool, as well as a document kind of archiving this work that is ongoing and continuing to happen. So that's it.
Okay, thank you for answering the first question. The second question is in three parts. I'm actually just going to read them all off now, so just try to keep them in mind while you're answering. The first question, or the first part of the second question, is in what ways does your group relate to the communities in which you work? The second part is, do you experience resistance to the organizing from parts of these communities, and how do you respond to that resistance? And the third part is, how do you hope to include more people from these communities in your projects? And we went a little over time for the first section, so try to keep your answers concise, and if you go over 4 or 5 minutes, we're going to kind of flash the sign for you here. So.
Second part about where you encounter resistance
to the different kinds of organizing. A lot of these that we were just listing off that happened in San Jose around debug are very mellow and really engaging with the community, and people love to be involved in it. The only place that we see resistance is from police and from some city administrators who just don't want to hear it. And specifically, you get told a lot, I can imagine, if you've lived on cop watching or any sort of direct intervention in a police interaction, have been told to back off and get away and that they're obstructing and that they're the problem. And we do get that a lot, but one thing that was kind of funny on the 3rd during Cinco de Mayo weekend a couple weeks ago, a cop told one of us they shined the bright light on him from the squad car and then asked, is that a camera or is that a gun? And so we got that on camera and got that taped, and now it's up on YouTube. And so we're going to be trying to get some notice given to local officials in San Jose, to the city council, to the mayor, to the public defender, the DA, everybody, that if there's anything ever happens to a cop watcher, that we're putting them on notice that they are going to be dealing with a lot of public outrage. And I would encourage anybody who has actual video of police harassing cop watchers, please put it up. I saw a really good one from Modesto, actually, on YouTube. So anyway, check YouTube for San Jose Cop Watch, and you can see that interaction.
And as far as having people participate with us, usually when clients come to us, they like the way we interact with the police, criminal justice attorneys, conflict lawyers, public defenders, your supervisors. We get the job done. Sometimes they hate to see us coming, but we keep on coming. So a lot of people remain and keep coming back to our Sunday meetings and want to be a part of it. So that's the thing about people. There's no, you can either work with the TV, the video, shoot the video, you can work with the Pop Watch, you can do the magazine, or you can do the social justice, or you can do all of it. Whatever you want to do is appreciated by D-Bug. There's no big youth or big eyes or little youth. Everybody is equal, and that's the beautiful part about D-Bug. You know?
Yeah, I forgot one other thing that I did mention is that there's a dark room, so if people like photography, if you're anywhere near the South Bay, come on down. It's open space. Yeah.
And I think it's the only one on the list. Negative class is also.
How do we hope to include more people from these communities and projects reduced by word of mouth? I didn't know about D-Bug until just last year in November. My daughter's go to City College. We just tried to, by word of mouth, in any way we can, let people know if they have that option.
How do we relate to the communities that we're working with? We're from the communities that we work in. You know, we're from those barrios. And the people that work with us that are not, either came from similar conditions or have grown up in similar life experiences. So through our organization, we've been involved in various projects. And through these projects, you know, we've actually also worked with different sectors in this community, such as age groups. We've been involved with immigration issues, with police harassment issues, with discrimination issues and educational issues. So we've made alliances with families, with mothers, fathers, children. You know, large majority of the young people that come through some of our projects, like our bike program that we started, you know, are elementary and high school students. So I believe that this organization is part of that community. You know, there's no separation there. Recently, we launched a Mira Watch program to deal with you know, the ICE raids that were happening in Watsonville. And part of this Mira Watch program, we've also helped launch a campaign against Wells Fargo, who's investing large sums of money in the private prison industrial complex. So these are the type of, you know, programs that we start in order to build alliances with our community.
Watsonville historically has been electorally run by a predominantly white city council that's controlled by the ag industry. It's the strawberry capital of the world. So in the mid-80s, there was a landmark Supreme Court case that created district elections. Once we had those district elections, we were able to get a city council that looked more like the community and represented the community more equitably. And I guess the most resistance that we face are the elite class, and that the vestiges of that class, their children, their neighbors, you know, it's a very segregated city and an area. There's unincorporated areas outside where the, you know, more elite people live, and then, you know, in town, the rest of us live. And it's not even the elite class these days. I see a large wannabe class, I call it. They're not elite. They're even people of color. And they're running for city council, and they write their little letters to the editor, and they do anything that they can to kind of echo and parrot the truly elite that have been sort of echoing and parroting this for a long time. Many of these folks grew up in Watsonville. They're white. They're of Croatian descent. Many are of Japanese descent. You know, and they just historically resent the worker class. Once the economy in Watsonville turned to strawberries, it's a very labor-intensive industry. You have a lot of workers that come seasonally to live, so there's a huge backlash against them. And you see that in that elite sort of community. How do we work with them, or how do we hope to include more people in these projects? You know, we don't actively seek to recruit these people into our projects or to get them to see things our way, quite honestly. But what we do is what we do. We believe that we have truth on our side, and we work with the community and on what we care about. And people do, I feel, come around because we're very open, we're very above ground. That's one of our strategies. People might think there's this secret underground militia that the Brown Berets have hiding, and they like to say things like that, and it's just not true. If you know, we're up front about everything, so we'll tell you to your face what we're about. And people are still afraid of that. So I think through some of the programs that we do, especially those that are just so obviously positive and so obviously creating, you know, that better alternative community that we all want to live in, whether you're, you know, whatever class you come from or where you come from or whose womb you popped out of, you know, we all want a better world. And I think that some of that is breaking, you know, breaking through. And, you know, that's where we're at.
How to answer this question. I think that primarily we work, the CopWatch group mainly works with young people and the immigrant community. I think those are the two communities that we are closest to. And the ways we relate to them, I mean, I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, when we're on the street doing CopWatch, and even when, like recently we've been doing a lot of canvassing and just talking to people, asking them questions, like we have a survey, we've been going door to door and asking people questions about their experiences with the police and how they feel about the police and like do they support alternatives to police interventions, that, and we get like, you know, there's differing views and stuff like that, and there's certainly like a lot of opposition to some of our positions, but like the idea of cop watching at least increase accountability at the very least has like near unanimous support in our community. And so talking with people when we're on the street doing cop watch, like I've never had someone say like, oh, get out of here, like don't watch this cop, you know, harass me, like whatever. So so that's good. And like I said earlier, we work really, really closely with the Committee for Immigrants' Rights, and most of us are members of that organization. I'd say the good majority of the people that are actively involved in our group are bilingual, and all of our materials are bilingual and stuff like that. So I think we just we relate to that community really well. We've talked about starting like a Migrant Watch, like SF has done and Watsonville has done, and we do have a kind of a loose network in place that when there's like checkpoints and things like that, people can call each other and something can happen. But you know, I'd like to see that increased. We also work a lot with families and victims of police abuse directly, and the way we interact with that community, people usually get a hold of us one way or another, and we kind of try to do what we can to support them and. It's as far as resistance goes, I wouldn't say we get resistance from that community, but you kind of have to tread a finer line because these are people who have just suffered like a really severe you know, tragedy in their lives, a severe loss. And so as I think as radicals, a lot of times we want to say, oh, you know, fuck that, like they just killed somebody, let's go out and like, you know, protest like crazy. And sometimes that's not in every situation the best thing, and sometimes that can turn people off, unfortunately. We don't encounter a lot of resistance from the general community, I think, like everyone else has said. And as far as, what was the last part of the question? Related, how do we get more people involved? Okay, we do a lot of canvassing, just getting out there, going door to door, and letting people know we're there. Just this last week, we've gotten numerous phone calls from people, so people know who we are and how to get a hold of us. Having a regular presence at other groups, events, and community events, even things that aren't political, like farmers markets, and just showing up and handing out information with your number and your meeting time, and encouraging people to get involved. And hopefully, we can allow a space for people to participate. I think it's really important, at least where we're at, and a lot of people in the Bay Area, for people that don't speak Spanish to learn Spanish. That's like really, really crucial if you're really going to be effective at, like, I think, bridging those gaps and having your stuff be bilingual. And I think trying to schedule your meetings and stuff like that and all your events at times that are beneficial for, or easier to access for people that have jobs, full-time jobs and families and stuff like that. But yeah.
Anyone I guess the first point, how do we relate to communities in which we work? Or we participate, because it's not really work, but we participate, right? I could say that we all have issues with cops, we all have issues with gentrification, the majority of us have issues with ICE, within our families or our good friends, And of course, we all have issues with capitalism, so this is like something that every member in our group, because we're a majority women, we're majority children of immigrants, we're majority bilingual speakers, we're all youth, and we're all poor. So I think that kind of creates a really good common enemy and a tight vision when we're relating to people in groups that are being criminalized the most. So we have no problems there. We have problems with people coming from outside communities. Like there was someone from another city who wanted to join our city because there's some kind of like magical like activist rep going on in the mission, and so like people from like other cities want to like participate in the collectives going on there. And it's like if people don't know you, if people don't if there's not already rapport going on, if you're not engaged with other groups, like it's just really weakening the group more than it's strengthening it. So and there's poor communities all over, and sure enough, I'm sure there's like poor white communities in other places and. Even in the city, there's like a lot of poor homeless white youth, and there's a lot of there's a lot of work to be done. So it's not like there's like something really important happening in the mission all of a sudden. Well, there is, right? But okay. Anyhow, so I have a key point. So I think some of where we come across resistance to organizing within these groups has definitely been a language barrier because not all of us are bilingual, and sometimes we get overtaxed with translating things, interpreting, always having to be there for the street watches because, we want to have someone translating things. So that can be like a huge burden. So, of course, we have a lot of issues with gentrification, and oftentimes it's been our main challenge is retaining people in the collective because it's so unaffordable to live in this area. It's so unaffordable. If you don't have like amazing rent control in the house that you live in, or squatting nearby and still have time to participate, you're basically like working so many hours just to be able to get by. And so that's really one of the biggest challenges that we have. Another huge challenge that we have in the communities that we're in, specifically with organizing the communities, capacity, I guess, is something that I've talked about a little bit. And also, I guess there's kind of, because there is such strong models of nonprofits in the mission, a lot of people already feel very committed to a certain group. And so if we're trying to do an event and we're not connected with this and this person or this and this group, there's a little bit less trust going on. So it's a little bit harder sometimes to build networks or to have coalition building when there's already like kind of like a dogmatic type of like one way is going to be my way of focusing all my energy and all my work. And there isn't like that much interest in organizing something that's really like door-to-door knocking type work, really, like getting to know people on the streets that live there and handing out papers and talking with them on a one-on-one basis. It seems a little more time-consuming and tougher, and it really is, than organizing enormous campaigns with like big funding and going straight to the governor. You know, it's a little bit more challenging, and I think that's like one of the hardest things that our group faces. But in terms of, let's see, including more people from these communities into our projects, I think that's our main attempt, is going to specifically like high schools, junior colleges, and trying to bring youth, and doing all the networking that we're doing. So I think I'm going to cut it there, because I think we've heard a lot of this. Okay.
So I'll try to answer this question the best that I can. I think it's a really, really series of questions. It's a really important question. And it's also really hard to address, because it can go a lot of directions. But critical resistance is purposefully a multiracial, multi-geographical, and multi-generational organization. So we recognize that the prison industrial complex affects each community, and also we recognize that it disproportionately targets poor communities and communities of color. So we prioritize the leadership of people who have experienced and are survivors of incarceration and police abuse, police violence. And that prioritization is very challenging for a lot of reasons. It's really challenging coming out of correctional facilities. very, 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 very challenging. And so our biggest challenge is trying to figure out ways to support members and people who want to access us consistently, and being able to overcome the everyday barriers of being outside when we don't provide services, because we're not a service-providing organization. Again, we focus more on political education. So that's why we do a lot of partnerships with groups that do provide services. And we're also not a single issue organization, which is both a strength and a challenge all the time. And so we don't have, like in the collective in Oakland, that collective looks very different than the collective in New York. We have chapters throughout the United States. And the Oakland chapter looks very different this year than it did 3 years ago. We're a really transient group, and we're constantly changing. So we relate to a lot of different communities. There isn't just one or two communities in Oakland that people in the CR chapter live in or represent in any way. Yeah, so then the work of trying to get more people included, specifically prioritizing people who are survivors of incarceration and police violence, that's just ongoing work. Some of the most effective things that we've done is just having like barbecues in the park, open barbecues, and just trying to get as many people walking down the street as possible, and then rotating those barbecues throughout Oakland, so not just focusing on one area. But trying to go both equally in West Oakland and then also at a few different parks in East Oakland. And also just like the general makeup of Oakland is very challenging. For instance, East Oakland geographically makes up more than half of the actual city now. And you have a lot of communities living in East Oakland, with many different kinds of relationships to the police on the street, and then also to the state in general, continuing to being targeted, criminalized, and demonized after being released from prison and being on parole. And the other thing that we've done some film screenings and just like general events, and the main thing that we're trying to work on is just demonstrating reliability and consistency with our relationships. And again, that's really hard because of the context that we're in.
All right, it's the home stretch. So the third and final question, it's a series of questions that I'm going to read it off together, is how do you envision communities decreasing the presence of law enforcement and increasing their capacity for self-determination over time. And knowing that there will always be various conflicts at, and at degrees of violence within our own communities, with or without police, can you envision alternative models for resolving community conflicts without the police? The big visionary one. And we're expecting the right answers.
We need to start with re-education our students, starting at K through 7, middle school, high school students, and making them aware of how the law works by doing scenarios when confronted with opposition, educating them on having weapons on them at being a minor. Some of them might carry the little pocket knives, or some kids just don't know that if you have a fight and one of your components walk away, and if you go after him, then you become not the aggressor, but you can also be charged with going after this person because he's turned them off the way. So, and a lot of kids don't know that back in the day when we fought. And, you know, you got beat up really bad, another guy walked away, you might ran after him and started fighting again. Now these kids are being charged with felonies. So just fully educating them on what happens when you fight, what happens if you have a weapon on you at school, that's a felony. Let's see, when a child is harassed by the police officers, empowering them to know what to say to the police officer, asking for the badge number. They are supposed to carry business cards, and a lot of them don't, but they can also write down the badge number, file complaints. You'd be surprised. The more they see you up at the police station, the more you file police complaints, and also get the media involved in it. Like my son, they did a cover story on Kareem and at the Metro newspaper, and it was awesome. So you'd be surprised how many people read the Metro. So it's just, you know, stay on top of things.
All right. The other parts that we had talked about in San Jose that we have experience with are doing political pressure on the structure itself, in terms of, you know, getting the word out, and we'd be rallying, having demonstrations, going to city council meetings, going to board meetings, and then, let's see here. And then trying to hold the police directly accountable in terms of, you know, being honest in their police reports, trying to point out inconsistencies, stuff like that. Just confronting racist attacks in the media by doing, you know, responding to articles when you hear them, you know, when you're reading them. Just make sure that you're commenting on them and not just cussing to yourself. Put it on there. And then another piece of it, you know, just in general, with the police, you know, the questions asking, how do you reduce the need for them to be there? How do you reduce their presence? And I feel like at some level, I mean, me personally, ideologically, I've got issues with them no matter what, but I feel like there's a piece of it which is about dispute resolution, and I really respect people who are coming up with ideas of how to do dispute resolution. I got a lot of questions for folks about that, but I feel like the dispute, the actual conflict, is between those who have money and resources and those who don't. And I feel that absolute change in the economic structure is absolutely prerequisite to getting rid of cops. If that's what people want, and they have dreams of a better world and all that, you have to make sure that people have what they need. And if they don't, there's going to be conflict and it's going to be bloody. And I really hope for better ways of resolving conflicts, especially over people getting their basic needs met. I'll just say that.
Just one more thing. They have programs for prison reentry, but people fail to realize that our youth that are off probation are not able to get trained, to get educated, so they can be productive citizens as they get older. And this is, if we figure out a way to do that for our young people, you know, so they can have a better future also. And I think they tend to carry themselves in a different way, more respectful, build self-esteem. And we have to also have probation reentry for those kids. Thank you.
I believe one of the best methods to ameliorate our community is through education. You know, and I mentioned that a few times before in passing out information about, you know, certain laws and the history of repression that's happening in our community, so they can understand it, so we can understand it and articulate it and have some points of unity where we could come together and address these issues. You know, and it's not only the repression that happens with police, but also the elite class with politicians, with teachers, with certain educators, with the media. You know, we really have to debunk the type of information that's provided through mainstream media, which really stigmatize a lot of youth of color. So we have to, you know, kind of debunk this by providing alternative information, you know, making young people feel proud of their history and the culture and their styles and where they come from, right? We also have to, like I mentioned earlier, we talked about the gang enhancement laws. And people who are not familiar with the gang enhancement laws, it's the Street Terrorism Enforcement Protection Act that was passed in the late 80s, but really enforced in the early 2000s. In 2006, they didn't even have to prove that, you know, some of these charges were, you know, for the benefit of a gang. And so this has been affecting a lot of young people throughout the state. Young people as early as 16, 17, because of Proposition 21, are being charged with gang enhancements, and they add anywhere from a 5-year to 10 to life sentence on top of crimes that, you know, they were just doing a few years on. And then I know communities like San Jose and a lot of communities in around the Los Angeles area are dealing with gang injunctions. And we really want to prepare our community for that, because that's something that, you know, they've been talking about and bringing to Santa Cruz also. And the gang injunction puts whole neighborhoods under intense police surveillance. And they create a whole list of, like, you know, stipulations that people could be violated for. And these violations are like curfews, hanging out in groups of more than three, associating with known gang members, right? And these gang members could be like relatives of individuals. And people have been violated for hanging out with their brother, right, or their cousin. I recently, one of my associates was violated on his parole conditions because he was pulled over with his brother. His brother's a known gang member. Or throwing up gang signs or certain clothing that young people are wearing. There was even a stipulation of people climbing a tree, being violated for climbing a tree, because they think that it's being a lookout. So this information has to be passed out. We have to provide the statistics. We have to provide, you know, the alternatives, the alternative community that we want to see. And we really have to emphasize our spirituality, our native ceremony, which I think are really important to young people of color and all people in general. Self-defense, not only just talk about some of the real self-defense, learning how to defend ourselves when you know, oppressors put their hands on us, right? And the alternative models that we've been really emphasizing is our bike program, you know, teaching young people mechanics and how to take care of the environment. Graffiti workshops, really taking value in their art that people have, that certain sectors of the society have stigmatized through hip-hop. And through really enforcing what the people like Matula Shakur and Tupac Shakur try to you know, push a few years back with street codes, you know, really enforce our own street codes, our own street ethics out there, you know, to kind of, you know, have a platform what to use that will not allow more police activity, you know, that allow our own communities to resolve conflicts, you know, to make it safer for young people and elderly people of the community. So I know there's a whole list, so you know, some of that information is available online. If people want to take a look at that. You know, street code is Bamatula Shakur.
Alliances and outreach is probably one of the best ways to decrease the presence of law enforcement. I think more and more if we can outreach and educate people as to the hard numbers and the cost of incarceration and the cost of trying young men four or five times. I know one man, he's 26, has been incarcerated for 2 years. He's on his fourth trial because they can't get a guilty verdict, and the DA has the right to continue to try him. That's just like one isolated case. But also not giving them any excuse to stigmatize us, like Tomas says, make people, you know, or you know, encourage folks, inspire folks to be, you know, proud and help them, you know, empower themselves to be aware and educated so that nobody has any reason, the cops don't have any reason to come down on folks. And also to work legitimately within the system in terms of as teachers, as teacher aides, and work with those people to get the message and to, you know, bring folks through to the different programs that we offer or that we do, that we participate in, and who you know, we're open to everybody. And the public is, you know, I think is open at this point to alternatives. And you know, people with a conscience and people that realize the truth, whatever, regardless of what color or class they are, I think are coming around. And we just have to, you know, use the tools of the oppressor to smash the oppressor by any means necessary. Right?
I would just echo like what's already been said, and I think what a lot of people in this room probably already know, in that. In order to eliminate police, I mean, you're going to have to eliminate the need for police, which means eliminating capitalism, which means, and really just government in general, because, I mean, even in Venezuela, I mean, what do they do to protesters? They shoot them with water cannons and shoot tear gas at them. I mean, and that's like the liberals, you know, heaven right now. So, I mean, unless, and so, I mean, that's a whole other issue. I mean, that's such a big picture issue, and it's great, and that's the importance of, you know, building coalitions, like everyone has said, is that if we're working on one issue, like police violence or immigrants' rights or all these things, we're not going to be able to work on other aspects of, you know, dismantling capitalism, but we need to accompany those struggles, and together, you know, we will do it eventually. And I think the state exists, you know, and this state of things exists in general because people believe in it. And if we didn't believe in it, it wouldn't exist anymore. So I think a lot of the work we have to do is changing our collective values as a society and kind of slowly destroying this general just faith and authority. Whether I think people, a lot of people support police accountability, but they still have this underlying faith that, like, ultimately authority can be used for good. And so I think until we get rid of that mindset, that value that I think a lot of people share, then we're not gonna, I think, go all the way. At the same time, I think you have to address, until you get to that point, address the legitimate concerns of the community in terms of public safety. Addressing any sort of antisocial behavior and trying to come up with ways that to solve it. I think, like has already been said, you know, a couple of times about coming up with creative solutions to conflict resolutions. I don't even need to go into that. Some examples, I mean, like in Oaxaca during the uprising there in 2006, you know, one thing they did was form neighborhood organizations because there were no cops in the city for the duration of that uprising for 5 or 6 months. And what they did was handed out whistles to everybody in the neighborhood. And if anyone was being accosted or something like that, someone would blow the whistle and like everyone would just come out, kind of swarm that person. You know, I don't know how people feel about this, or I don't know how I feel about it, you know, but they would take the person and just like tie that person up to a pole for like a little while, hang a sign on them and said robber, you know, and there was this whole spirit of solidarity. It was like seeing if you're robbing your own neighbor, then you're like a traitor to this whole movement, this whole spirit of solidarity. And so, I mean, that's kind of an example, I think. And in terms of, like, in a future society, like, if there's not going to be police, how are we going to resolve those issues? I mean, I don't know. I feel like once you, if you create an egalitarian society, and like you said, if we end capitalism and all that stuff, like, you're going to see most of these crimes disappear. I mean, realistically, like, a lot of these crimes, or a lot of the issues that we see coming up are from inequality and from desperation and from a toxic, just, like, isolated culture where people have nothing to do and where people are desperate. They don't have jobs and they're, you know, broke and, like, they're just... There's nothing of value in this culture. And so I think that would be part of it. And then when you create democratic communities and like some places have done with general neighborhood assemblies and things like that, you know, those issues can be resolved within those assemblies. People can just collectively in their own neighborhoods discuss what issues are most important and then how are they going to solve that. And a lot of that is just getting creative with our conflict resolution, like people said. Anyway.
Can we do
more
time? Okay, I'm going to try my best to not be repetitive, but just a quick example of something that we've seen in San Francisco. One of the reasons that SF, Company of Us, started in the first place was because we noticed the rise in SF safe neighborhood watch groups in San Francisco. These are groups that started with the police department to begin with. They transitioned into being a kind of like a government nonprofit, and they basically, like, the board of directors are composed of, like, banks, realtors, Walgreens, corporations, you know? So it's like really evident like what their main motivations are. And their main purpose in creating like neighborhood watch groups is basically to create a really safe space for a lot of new people who are like gentrifying different areas of San Francisco, right? So, So basically what we've been doing in situations where we know there's a meeting happening in our neighborhood, we alert people, we go, we protest, we offer alternatives. And it's, we're trying to create not necessarily like different types of cop watch groups all over the place, but kind of like a response to these neighborhood watch groups at the very least. So we're trying to decrease the idea of like police first and then talking to our neighbors, to switching that type of like very stereotypical like American individualistic, like very wanting to see like results immediately, towards something that's a little bit more slower, more developing, more community oriented. And I think that might be like trying to create those bridges within like something that's so negative right now and so entrenched within the police, to break it up and start pushing for alternatives. Like, for example, there's this incredible program happening in the Mission, and I believe in the TL as well, and also in the Bayview. Eddie Tseng, I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with him, but he's a San Francisco resident who from youth, he just did a ton of time in jail, came out of that and wanted to like fix the world completely, and then started doing this by like helping create communities where there's different types of interventions that take place, primarily within high schools. Security guards that see that or hear of something or get reported something might be taking place will contact this group of mediators to come and bring family, bring other teachers, and bring the students who might have gotten into an altercation beforehand to like hash it out and reach an accord and negotiate before anything might happen outside of the schools later on, right? Because things inside the schools don't necessarily, like, it's not as visible as like coming to the school, leaving the school. Those are like the really, really dangerous spots. So there's also like groups of people who just walk down the street and talk to people. They talk to the youth out on the porches and let them know, look, if you need any resources medically, in terms of mediation, anything, we do not work with the police whatsoever. They work with hospitals, for instance, in case there's like a stabbing or some kind of like drive-by, so they get immediately first aid response without their names having to be given, without any type of like insurance or anything. It's just like kept like really, really like under profile for youth's protection, basically. And so there are these like incredible examples of organizing that are and like survival, right? That are really like encouraging youth to like have each other's back, to like try to do like to work with these other groups that they know and understand are not working with the police, right? So this is kind of what we're trying to promote. Absolutely, like a holistic decrease in participating in the capitalist system as a whole is really what's going to lead to lesser and lesser criminalization, right? Both by the migra and by police. Because if we have healthy communities, not only in the US, but all over the world, we have sustainability projects, we have autonomy projects, then there's not going to be as much need for immigration as we have right now. There's not going to be as much need as migra. We want to completely do away. Basically, our whole like attempt is promote visions. So whenever we do a Know Your Rights workshop with youth, we always try to promote visions of like what would a world would look like without borders, what a world would look like without police. And we really encourage and push youth to think about examples and how that would look like, how they would have to change their lives. And so this is really kind of like envisioning a lot, but also doing like direct action type of like defense work in the streets as well. And you know, honestly, like this is all really easy to talk about in these spaces at AK Press in these communities, and really to be able to promote these ideas, I believe, is really important in communities where people are being like first victimized or first being profiled, right, by police and media as well. So I think this is really encouraging. I love hearing all your inspiring stories, and I'd love for us to like get together again and do this in places where it's going to affect people that are mainly being targeted and who might be interested in joining our groups.
So I'll try to be quick because I feel like everything that I kind of wanted to talk about was definitely mentioned, so thank you all for being so thorough. I guess one thing that I kind of wanted to add is specifically, and like looking into Oakland, one thing that we do with critical resistance is focusing on how much money is spent on policing and prisons, and if we put that money directly into our basic needs for survival, right? So the communities that do not have, who don't have access to basic needs for survival, meaningful jobs, affordable housing, food, education, all of these things, right? Those are the conditions that we need in order to create real safety in our community, in our communities. And at the same time, we also need to be practicing our capacity that we do have right now, not just in the future, for collective self-determination. And so, to me, decolonizing our minds isn't just understanding how fucked up the world is, but instead practicing alternative ways of relating to each other. So an example, a few weeks ago, I went to Durham, North Carolina, and I was hanging out with some people that I'm close with, and they've just spent the past 7 years getting off the ground their first harm-free zone. And a harm-free zone is a long-term strategy for abolishing the prison industrial complex, where you set up community networks to intervene in situations of harm without involving policing or prisons. And their model specifically combines a lot of different models of intervention, prevention, reparation, and transformation. And I brought a lot of information with me. I unfortunately don't have copies, but if people are interested in talking to me about this afterwards, I definitely am interested in these ongoing conversations. But I guess the main thing I just wanted to kind of emphasize is that that to try to break away from thinking about things really linearly and individually, and I think that that's one of the really harmful consequences of capitalism, and to say that we need to do this one thing first before we stop relying on police, in my opinion, I don't think we're really going to get there when we need to. I think we need to also, at the same time, stop relying on police, because when we turn to each other, we start to provide for each other. And that is being practiced in a lot of ways right now here in Oakland, maybe not within the centralized spaces of organizing within the nonprofit industrial complex, but it is definitely being practiced. So I just want to end with that.
All right, well, first, if we can have a quick round of applause for all the panelists.